But despite Samson's bad choices, what is it that God can always do? He can use, absolutely. And we have several examples in the Scripture. One that I thought of most of was Joseph's brothers. God did not cause them to hate Joseph. That was on them. But later, Joseph said three times in chapter 45, verses 4 through 8 of Genesis, that it was not you who sent me here, but God did. So God used the hatred and the enmity of Joseph's brothers to bring about his purpose. Is God seeking an occasion against the Philistines? Yes, the text says that. Well, how's that going to come about? Well, God's going to let people make their choices. Those choices could be good, they could be bad. But at any rate, that's God being who He is. He can take a man's good choice, take a man's bad choice, and still accomplish His providential will among men. And that points to His omniscience and His omnipotence as God. Okay, let's talk now about Samson's story here. The first four verses, and one way to look at this chapter is three different journeys to Timnah, or three different times he went to Timnah. Timnah was a city in northern Judah. Again, if you are consulting a Bible map during these classes, you'll see that it's in extreme upper Judah, almost to the border of Dan. It's a little southwest from Zorah. Of course, that's the hometown that he is from, his parents, his father Manoah. And just looking at the map, the direction from Zorah to Timnah is southwest, just a little, not much, but it is. And so that's in the direction of Philistia. It's going toward the Philistines. So he goes to Timnah. And while he's there, what does the story begin with? He sees what? He saw a woman. He saw a woman, and is she just any woman? She's the daughter of the Philistines. All right? Now, Timnah is a town in Judah, but she's not a Hebrew woman. She's a Philistine woman, one of the daughters of the... So that tells us again that the Philistines, on occasion, and they did this with some regularity, they would make excursions in from the west and invade into the land of Canaan and oppress the Hebrews, oppress the Israelites, take up residence in some of those far western areas of the land of Canaan. So he sees the woman, she's obviously beautiful, and so he goes home and tells his parents what, basically? Yeah, get her for me. I want her as a wife. Verse 2, I saw a woman in Timnah, one of the daughters of the Philistines, now therefore go get her for me as a wife. Simple request, straightforward request. But now let's spend some time looking at his parents' reaction. They object on two points. Look at their objection. What's the first thing they say? They say, could you not find a wife from among your own relatives? And then, in a more broader sense, even from all of Israel. Couldn't you find a Hebrew woman to be your wife? Now, was that a valid objection on their part? Absolutely it was. What is it that parents want for their children with respect to them finding a mate, a spouse? And by that I mean parents who are trying to follow and serve God. What do they want? That's right. We want for you someone who's going to love God like the way we've tried to raise you, and who will help you serve God later on in your adult life. Well, that was their first objection. But they said something else then too about this woman, and not just about her, but about her people. What did they say next? And they just didn't say Philistines. Uncircumcised Philistines. Why mention uncircumcision? Why mention that? That's important. See, what did circumcision represent? It was the sign of the covenant. And so if a group of people were not circumcised, that meant what? They were not the people of God. They didn't care about God. They didn't follow His covenant. They didn't follow His will. They lived their own lives. Not to jump ahead too much, and really it's a different story, but remember in the story of David and Goliath. David goes out to meet Goliath, who was a Philistine, obviously, by birth. And what did he call him? This uncircumcised Philistine. So to make that designation indicated that his parents here stating this, they recognized this is a person who's not in covenant with the God that we serve. And so what's the problem if he marries her? Absolutely. We're going to have an issue where the person not in covenant with God can take this one away in marriage and lead him away from God. And because marriage, we know, those of us who are married, is so intimate, it's so close. The ties that exist in a marriage are so strong that one will influence or affect the other. Lead one way or lead one the other way. And so, okay, yeah, Fred, let's get to that. Deuteronomy 7. Freddie's point was that it violated the law. What had God said about the Hebrews marrying someone else outside the... He said, you're not to do it. For the reason that Doug mentioned, they'll take your heart away from me and you'll start serving their gods. Now, someone could go to Deuteronomy 7 and you won't find the Philistines listed there among the peoples. I admit that. But there's an interesting statement in Joshua 13 and verse 3. When they go to divide up the land, Joshua records that quite often, just for identification purposes, the Philistines or Philistia was a lot of the times recognized or identified as Canaanite. And Canaanites are listed in Deuteronomy 7. So I'm not going to say for sure that this was a violation, but I think one could make a pretty good argument that it was. Now, Samson wanting this kind of woman for a wife indicates what about his own spirituality? It's shallow. I'm not going to say he didn't have any, but I think it's shallow. It's at least not the concern that his parents had. They had this concern, and so they object to their son's request. I think Samson's next statement indicates where his criteria is. So he hears his parents' objection. He persisted on what basis? This is verse 4, or the last part of verse 3. Yeah, she looks good to me. I want her because she's physically appealing. She's pretty, she's good looking, whatever the criteria was. She looks good to me. Literally that phrase means, my margin has, she is right in my eyes. She passes the test. Application. We have marriages sort of on the same criteria in present day culture? Do some folks marry for a reason like, maybe for this exact reason, or for reasons like it? Some marry for wealth. Some marry for prestige, prominence in society, whatever it may be. And some marry, sadly, just because the other person is just physically attractive. What's the problem with those criteria? Oh, yeah, I mean, if you're making a lot of money right now, you could lose your job and then the money goes away. What if you're young and pretty? Or young and handsome? What happens to all of us? We get old and ugly. We all age. And those attributes, they just go away. And they're just so shallow upon which to base something as important as marriage. But if one is godly in his or her youth, what can he or she be when they're later in life? They can still be godly. And that hold is still there. That characteristic, that conviction is still there. Well, possibly so. Maybe he thought, I'll change her. And how many folks say, well, after we get married, then I'll change him or her. How often does that happen? Does it happen? I'm sure it happens some, but it don't happen very often. In fact, it works more the other way. The unbeliever often changes the believer. And then he or she eventually falls away. So this little part of Judges 14, I think it's good for parents. It's good for teenagers, those who are of dating age, those who are thinking about contemplating marriage. It's a good story to read. After all, one of the classic verses in Romans 15 is verse 4, the things written aforetime written for our learning. We can read this and we can learn from this. Here's some principles at work here that help us as parents and as children who are old enough to be thinking about dating and marriage. Look at the objection that Samson's parents raised. There's some truth to this, and we need to see the wisdom of that. Okay. Well, another observation, I believe Samson's identity as a Nazarite should have prevented him from having this desire. Remember back in Numbers 6, we read where you read about the Nazarite vow. A Nazarite was one who was dedicated or separated to the Lord. Well, how could one be that dedicated or be separate to Jehovah when he would have this desire to marry a person from an uncircumcised people? Is that a disconnect? I think that's a disconnect. The vow, yes, that's the point. The vow was not his. God chose him to be a Nazarite, but he was still to behave as a Nazarite, even though he didn't make that choice. And in fact, skipping ahead just for the moment, look in chapter 16 and verse 17. When he finally tells Delilah his secret, look at what he says. He told her all that was in his heart, and he said to her, "A razor has never come upon my head. Why? For I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb." He understood some part of that. He knew the kind of life he was supposed to have lived. He had been taught that. So whatever his level of understanding was, Freddie, I don't know, but at least he knew. I think your point is, I mean, obviously it's correct. He didn't choose to do this, but he should have chosen to live that way. That's what God expected of him. And having this desire is not congruent with that. So, let's make good application regarding New Testament Christians and their prospective marriages. Not only should we not marry unbelievers who will take us away from God. Now, we can convert anybody. We need to be converting the whole world, obviously. But do you have to marry an unbeliever to convert him or her? Well, of course not. But what I'm addressing here is we shouldn't even want to marry someone who could potentially take us away from serving God. Where is the desire? Where is the want to being faithful to God? I think that's the point that we're trying to make here with respect to Samson. All right. Any other comments through the first four verses? Okay. Freddie's point is verse 4. The text says that the Lord was seeking an occasion. His parents were unaware that this was of the Lord and that he was seeking an occasion. Now, being good students that hopefully we are, since we've read this story before, we know how it's going to turn out. Okay? The events that come into play with respect to this woman and her family and the riddle and Samson's motive of revenge, was it going to be an occasion where he could strike a blow against the Philistines? Yes, and that's going to happen. But this statement that it was of the Lord, does that necessarily mean that it had divine approval? That God wanted Samson to marry the Philistine woman? No, we can't make it say that. It was of the Lord in that God was going to use it in his providential plan. But would God have wanted Samson to marry a person from the uncircumcised? I don't think we can make that argument. Now, maybe I'm incorrect about that. But God's going to let Samson make his choice. No, he didn't make him do it. That was Samson's choice. But that's the beauty of providence. Even when I don't do right, and I'm supposed to do right, and God would want me to do right, but even when I don't, God can still take me in my bad choices and work it out to accomplish his will. That's because he's God, and that's the beauty of providence. So he's going to use this as we see the story unfold. It will be an occasion where Samson can strike a blow against the Philistines and begin this delivering process that was said back in chapter 13 and the end of verse 5. He will begin to deliver his people from the Philistines. All right, there was the first journey to Timnah. Now here's the second journey, which I think goes from verses 5 through 7 of chapter 14. Samson went down to Timnah with his father and mother. So apparently this was a trip to possibly arrange the marriage. His parents had to go along to make whatever arrangements were necessary in that culture. And on the way, they obviously separate. I think we can say that because the end of verse 6, his parents didn't know what happened with respect to the lion. I mean, if they were there to see it, then there'd be no secret. I mean, obviously. So for some reason, they separate on the journey, and while Samson's by himself, what happens along the way? Well, this isn't a little cub. I think this is a full-grown young male, perhaps a female. It doesn't say lioness, it says a lion. But this lion comes roaring out at Samson, just doing what lions do. That's just what he's supposed to do. And then we have this phrase, verse 6, that we'll see over and over in Samson's story. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily. It was a reception, if you will, of superhuman strength. And how does he treat the lion? As if it were a cub. He just rips it apart. What's he got in his hands to do it? He had nothing. He just uses his raw human strength and just rips this thing like it's a doll or a toy and kills it. That had to have been impressive for a man to be that strong to do that. Okay. Well, he didn't tell his parents what he had done. I've asked the top of page 30, this is question 6, and we'll come to that thought question in a moment. Why do you suppose he didn't tell his parents about the lion or about the honey? That's a good thing to think about. Now, he continued to desire the young Philistine woman because of her looks. I think we can say that. Verse 7, he went down and talked to the woman, and she looked good to Samson. He continued to have that thinking. Well, we come to verse 8, and it seems it says that he returned later to take her, so he obviously left. Now he's going back to get her, and so on the way to Timnah for a third time, whatever the lapse of time has been, we don't know. But what about that lion carcass? Well, it's still laying there, but what's happening inside of it? All right, bees have swarmed, and they've obviously made some honey. Now, I don't know anything about bees, but this is not usual, is it? Typically, do bees avoid dead things? I would think they do. I think I read somewhere where they don't typically expose themselves to something that would be this decaying or this putrid, if you will. I mean, because that lion is dead. It's just been laying there rotting out in the sun, perhaps, and inside the well of the carcass, because it's just been ripped open. Bees have made a hive, or they have made honey. So what did Samson do? Well, he took some of the honey for himself, and then also for his parents, did he not? And again, you'll see at the end of verse 9, he has still the same secret. Well, what does he not do? He didn't tell them where he got the honey. Now, I'm just asking, and this is speculative because the Bible doesn't say, but what are your feelings? What are your thoughts about why he didn't tell his parents that he'd killed the lion the way they did and he didn't tell them where he got the honey? Well, Samson, where'd you get the honey? Well, he didn't tell them. Well, I just found it somewhere. All right, could this be a violation of the Nazarite vow? I think it very well could be. My feeling is that it is. It seems to be at odds with his vow. He touched a dead body. Number 6 in verse 6, part of the vow said, now some versions say not to go near a dead person. Some versions say not to go near a dead body. Now, is it a person or is it a body? Well, is it anything dead? I think that would be the greater concern, not just a dead human, but any dead body, because it would be of a defiling nature. It would be unclean to go near something like that. Even outside the Nazarite vow, Leviticus 11, verse 27 says, for any Hebrew, not just a Nazarite, but any Hebrew, for any animal that walks on all four paws, you are not to touch their carcass. But is that a lion? He walks on all four paws. So for any Hebrew to go near that would have been defiling. But again, how does the Nazarite stand up next to the average Hebrew? Yeah, he's to be one cut above that. He's been set aside in this vow to live a separate, dedicated life and to try his best, her best, whoever it may have been taking the vow, to live a life that would reflect the seriousness of that vow. And Samson, on this occasion, does not do that. I'm not trying to be overly hard on Samson, but again, what is the prevailing culture of the days of the judges? We try to make this point often. Idolatry? What about their overall level of spirituality? It's weak. It's not good. So here now is this man, Samson. He appears to be very much a man of his day, a man of his times. He was much alike the Hebrews in that respect. But God, being who He is, He can use this man, and He will, to lead Israel to, again, strike these vengeful blows against Philistia and to begin to end some of this Philistine oppression. So he didn't tell his parents about the lion or about the honey. Okay. Mm-hmm. Right. Could have been. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Bernie's point is true. Now, Samson is of age. He's his own man. But Bernie's point is the parents seem to yield. I mean, they said first, don't marry this woman. But what do they wind up doing? They go to make the arrangement for the marriage. And to whatever extent we as parents can exercise that kind of control over our children, we may have to just finally say, you're not doing that. Now, if they're on their own, they're their own adults, we've lost that ability because they don't live under our roof anymore. So to whatever, I think Bernie's point is valid, to whatever point we can exercise that control as their parents, we need to do that. We need to do that. Okay. Now, in Timnah, this is question 7, page 30. In Timnah, Samson gives a feast. We've come now to verse 10. His father went down to the woman, and Samson made or gave a feast, for the young men customarily did this. And it came about when they saw him that they brought 30 companions to be with him. The Hebrew word for feast here is a drinking feast, a drinking party. It wasn't just a banquet food. I'm sure food was there, but the word seems to emphasize it was more about the drinking than about the eating. Okay, if we stop right there, what should be flashing red lights in our mind here? The Nazarite vow. What was the portion of the Nazarite vow that comes in play here? No strong drink, and not just the strong drink, it said, back in number 6. Nothing to do with the grape from seeds to skin. Total abstinence from the vine or the fruit of the vine. Pardon? Yes, nothing to do. So even if he didn't drink, now someone says, well, are you accusing Samson of drinking? I can't say that he did. All I know is that it says he gave the feast. But even if he didn't drink himself, but he just played host to the feast of a drinking party, drinking feast, does that seem congruent with the Nazarite vow? Not to me, it doesn't. I mean, that's a terrible lapse in judgment. What is the reason for this party anyway, verse 10? What's it say at the end of verse 10? Why was the feast given in the first place? Here's the thing. Yeah, is the custom to do it? I mean, that's just what you do when you have a marriage in Timnah. It's the groom's part to give a feast. And so, Samson, you need to sort of own up here and do like all the other grooms in the area do. That's just the thing to do. The custom or habit, if you will. But just because something is customary, does that mean that a child of God needs to abandon his principles just to satisfy a custom? Of course not. See, we've got to live a cut above that. And that's one thing that we need to tell our children, isn't it? As you get older, you're going to be faced with more and more of these kinds of decisions. And it may be that someday you have to draw a line in the sand and say, look, that's a line that I just can't cross. Well, but you know, everybody does it. It's the customary thing to do. Well, so what? I don't live like the world. I try not to live that way. I've got to follow the teachings of my God, and He has certain expectations of me. Samson, again, being this Nazarite, a life of dedication. Can it be said that we today have a life of separation and dedication to the Lord as New Testament Christians? Well, obviously, we are. And our lives have to reflect that. So, be not deceived. Evil companions do what? They corrupt good morals. And Paul wrote the Thessalonian brethren to abstain from every appearance or every form of evil. We've got to abstain from it. Even if the world says, well, there's nothing wrong with that. Not only is that not wrong, that's customary. Well, that's not our creed. We don't live that way. We've got to be people of something. We've got to be people of substance. And Samson seems to have used, at the very least again, if he did not drink, he uses very bad judgment here, I believe, in giving this feast for these friends. So, we've come to the feast now, obviously, and during the course of the party, what does Samson do? This starts here in verse 12. All right, let me give you guys a puzzle. Sort of lighthearted thing. Let me propose to you a riddle. And what was the terms of the riddle? I'll tell you the riddle. Now, if you can solve my riddle, then I'll do what? I'll give you 30. This course is to match the 30 men that came, verse 11. So I'll give you 30 changes of raiment, 30 changes of clothes, if you can guess my riddle. But if you can't guess my riddle, well, then you have to pay me 30 changes of clothes. It may seem agreeable to that. Verse 13 concludes, propound your riddle that we may hear it. Samson, you have a deal. And so what was the riddle? Doug, read for us verse 14. Here's the riddle. All right, that's even poetic, isn't it? Out of the eater came something to eat, and out of the strong came something sweet. Now, obviously, we know the story. What's he talking about? The lion and the honey. The lion and the honey. Nobody was around to see that. Not even his parents knew the riddle. And doesn't he say that later when the woman is trying to coerce the story out of him? Look at the end of verse 16. What does Samson even say to her? She's pressing him, so, you know, you hadn't told me this. And he said, well, I didn't even tell my parents about this. So this riddle was known only to Samson. It's a secret. And again, as we discussed earlier, the fact that bees would swarm and make a hive and make honey in a whatever's left of a carcass seemed so unusual that it provided a good basis for this riddle that usually probably no one would guess that's what he's talking about. So he thought that'd make a good riddle, and so that's what he did. So for 3 days it says that they could not guess it. They just tried and tried, and they couldn't figure it out. And so then they decide to let's make this a little more to our favor. What did they do? That's right. They go to his wife. And they just don't ask pretty please, will you get Samson to tell us the riddle or to tell you the riddle, but they even threaten her. With what? We'll burn you and your father's house down on you if you don't get your husband, Samson, to tell you the riddle, then you come tell us. After all, who is she again? She's Philistine. Who are these men again? It doesn't say, but I think we have to infer they're Philistines. So see, he's the foreigner. He's the one not like us. You're supposed to side with us in this. And so you get the idea, you get the secret out of him. And then we'll be happy and you'll avoid death. Let's just put it that way. You'll be safe that way. So she presses Samson. This is, verse 15. They tell her, entice your husband. So I wonder with what methods she tried to extract his secrets. Who knows? But anything's game. Entice your husband that he may tell us the riddle, lest we burn you and your father's house with fire. Have you invited us to impoverish us? Is this not so? Samson's wife wept before him. And she said things like what? Verse 16. Samson, you hate me. You must really hate me. Really working on the the sob story here. You only hate me and you do not love me. You have propounded a riddle to the sons of my people and have not told it to me. And she's basically saying, I have the right to know this, and you're not telling me. Again, what does Samson say at the end of verse 16? Well, now, wait a minute. I didn't even tell my parents this. I certainly haven't told you. I hadn't even told them. But she presses on, and she keeps on. Can Samson be worn down by a woman? He can. We see it in this chapter, and we'll see it again in chapter 16 with respect to who? Delilah. We'll see it then again as well. So, middle part of verse 17. It came about on the seventh day that he told her because she pressed him so hard. She just would not relent. And he finally broke. Then she told the riddle to the sons of her people. So he told her, she told the people, or these men, and then they in turn come to Samson. Here is verse 18. So the men of the city said to him on the seventh day before the sun went down, what is sweeter than honey? And what is stronger than a lion? They got it. Now did Samson scratch his head and say, well, how did you figure that out? No, he says one more thing here, sort of poetic. Samson was not fooled by this. What does he say next? All right, if you had not plowed with my heifer, my version says, you would not have found out my riddle. What does it mean to plow with my heifer? That's an obscure thing to say. You've used that phrase lately? I've never used that phrase before in my life. What does it mean? Okay, you're in cahoots with the enemy. You have found out this riddle in an unlawful way. You've used my wife in a way that's not right. Again, what was their level of coercion on the woman? Either tell us or what? You die. I mean, that's they put the screws to her. So this provided the occasion for which God would use Samson. How this all played out now? How mad is Samson? What happens when Samson gets mad? He gets physical. He gets physical. And boy, can he get physical. He can do it. And so again, what did it say back in verse 4? When this whole thing started to play out, now we've walked through the story. The parents did not know that this desire of Samson for this woman was of the Lord, that God was seeking an occasion. Well, are we going to have the occasion now? It's fixing to come. It's fixing to come. The occasion to strike this blow against the Philistines. So what does Samson do to get the 30 changes of raiment? Okay, I mean, he's going to pay his debt. Okay, he goes to Ashkelon, which is a Philistine city, and he kills 30 men. Takes their spoil, takes their clothing, and gave the changes of clothes to those who told the riddle. So, in essence, all right, here's your clothing. But to get the clothing, what does he do? He kills 30 Philistines. God's going to use that, see, to do. Did God go tell Samson, go kill those men? No, that was his choice. And he did that out of personal revenge. But God used it nonetheless to strike a blow against the Philistines. And he pays his debt that way. So the Spirit of the Lord came on him mightily, and in his strength he slew these 30 Philistines and used their garments to give to the young men who had unethically solved his riddle. They used a coercion against his wife. What does it say next about his anger? It says his anger burned about the whole situation. He was hot about it. And so what did he do in his anger? End of verse 19. He goes home. He goes home to Zorah. He leaves Timnah and goes back to his father's house. It's as if he's saying, you know, I've had enough of this mess. This is awful. So I'm going home to my parents' house. Are Samson and the woman married? They are biblically. Now remember, there's difference in culture. the marriage was not yet consummated sexually, but they were married. And so there was some level of expectation that, you know, really she belongs to Samson. Well, that's true. Freddie's point is maybe there was some sexual behavior. It says that she enticed him. Perhaps that could have been involved. That's a possibility. Be that as it may, though, he leaves his wife and goes back home. And what does the woman's father do? All right, his thinking was obviously what? The woman's father. Well, you've left. You're not here anymore, so I'm going to give her to someone else. And who is the man that she's given to? Yeah, my version says that to the man who had been his friend, but marginally it says who had been his best man. What was usually the best man's obligation? To look out for whose interests? The groom's. And now he's been given Samson's wife. Well, that's where the chapter concludes. But thinking ahead just for the moment, because you know the next story, how does that factor into the next phase of Samson's story? Again, Samson's anger will wax hot. He'll be full of rage and revenge again, and he'll use what just happened here to strike yet another blow against the Philistines. The first blow only affected 30 men. They lost their lives. His next blow, which is chapter 15, are more than 30 affected? A lot more than 30. He'll ravage those crops. And you'll see to the extent that Samson inflicts damages upon the Philistines. Again, how does his life end? Which we'll get to chapter 16. He killed more at that moment than at any other time in his life. So his blows or his strikes against Philistia grow in strength or in number, if you will. They get bigger. They get more damaging. So that's our trip through the 14th chapter. Anybody have a closing comment or observation, a question to make before we're through with class this morning? Anything that I did not cover that you thought was noteworthy? Yeah. And that's the Philistine culture. And so Bernie's point is when you get involved with people who don't have any spiritual character or conviction, my phrase, I like, you know, you're swimming with the sharks. I mean, you're out there where you don't need to be. And nothing good can come from that. And I think we see that played out here in this story. Good comment, Bernie. Okay. Thank you for your participation. We'll pick up class, Lord willing, on Wednesday night with chapter 15, lesson 15.